堂听 class.com
第三十七单元房产政策
Unit 37 Housing Policies
篇章交传
Passage for consecutive interpretation Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I am honored and delighted to have the opportunity to return to my alma mater and address this distinguished gathering. The Asia-Pacific Network for Housing Research plays an important role as a forum for academics and professionals within the region to exchange ideas and experience that relates to research into housing and social development. Your sharing of such valuable knowledge and information would in turn facilitate our efforts to continuously improve the quality of the housing that we provide for our community. In a moment, I will share with you some of our recent experience in formulating housing policies and programs. Perhaps I should begin with a brief recap of the major trends that have affected this area in the past few decades, as this will serve to put our policies and strategies into context. Over the past 50 years, we have pursued a vigorous public housing program to meet the changing needs and aspirations of our community. We began by providing very basic accommodation to those who were homeless or living in very poor conditions. When that was accomplished, we started to build better designed and self-contained housing estates to meet the rising aspirations of the community. Over the past few years, we have managed to deliver a number of our more ambitious goals set in the 1990s. We have now cleared all the temporary housing areas and cottage areas in the territory. The number of people who live in substandard or overcrowded accommodation now stands at an all-time low. Recently, the government announced its revised statement on housing policy, which spelled out in very clear terms the different roles played by the government and the market in the housing sector. It made clear that the government will confine itself to the provision of public rental housing for families who cannot afford private housing. In order to give full effect to this policy stance, the government will cease playing the role of property developer by halting the production and sale of public subsidized flats under the home ownership scheme. The statement also underlined the importance of maintaining a stable environment to enable the sustained and healthy development of the property market on a level playing field. The three most basic policy considerations upon which the statement was founded are 1. Providing for the underprivileged, 2. Keeping market intervention to the minimum, and 3. Providing a stable level playing field. Looking from a macro perspective, our economy is showing healthy signs of recovery after the adversities we have been through in recent years. One aspect of the economic recovery and improvement of public sentiment we are now witnessing has been the gradual revival of the property market. There have been initial signs of a rebound in recent months. We firmly believe that a clear, comprehensive, and consistent housing policy will be instrumental in restoring the long-term confidence of the public and investors. We will continue to implement and consolidate our policy in this regard. We are, of course, continuing to strive relentlessly for other improvements in our subsidized housing program. We will achieve them through closer and more effective cooperation with all the stakeholders in this area, including the construction industry, the property sector, and most importantly, the community as a whole. We will listen ever more carefully to the community's views about public housing, and we will make every effort to meet its needs. We will strengthen our partnerships with the construction industry and housing professionals. Together with them, we will explore and implement innovative new design concepts and construction technologies that will enable us to build better homes in a smarter and more cost-efficient way. Working closely with residents, we will further upgrade the quality of the maintenance and management of public housing estates to make them cleaner, healthier, and more environmentally friendly places to live. The purpose of the repositioned housing policy framework I have just described is to facilitate a more clear-cut demarcation of the public and private sectors. Our success in doing so will depend on our ability to make the most effective use of our valuable housing resources in both the public and private sectors under changing economic and social conditions. While I recognize that every society in the region faces its own unique housing issues, I know that we face many common challenges. So I hope your conference will facilitate the exchange of valuable experience and information about this important aspect of social development in this region and elsewhere. And I am convinced that you will leave with fresh insights and inspiration to tackle the tasks that are ahead of you in the years ahead. Thank you.
第38单元, 电脑技术.
Unit 38. The Computer Technology.
篇章交传.
Passage for Consecutive Interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Today's lecture on computer know-how will focus on two problems. One is about the plug-in technology, and the other is about virus programs. Life online can be a much richer experience when you aren't restricted to just written words and still pictures. Even if you're new to the net, you've probably heard about multimedia online, listening to audio, watching animations and videos, even playing in three-dimensional space. Sound and movement make information come alive. To experience it, you'll need special pieces of software called plugins. The term plugin refers to a small add-on piece of software which extends the capabilities of your web browser, like Netscape Navigator or Microsoft Explorer, turning your computer into a radio or TV. When you arrive at a web page which contains a file requiring a plugin which you don't have, you will usually receive a message asking if you want to get it by downloading it and installing it into your computer. Most of the time, the installation will be automatic. Occasionally, you'll run into a downloaded file which needs to be decompressed or unzipped before installation. Once installed, plugins run automatically, without you having to do anything. Many multimedia controls still need to be obtained from the developer, but are installed automatically. Shockwave is a good example of this. All you need to do is go to the Macromedia site and click on the link to install the ActiveX control. The rest happens automatically. The next time you go to a shocked website, the Shockwave control loads and plays the movie. Most plugins and controls can be downloaded for free on the internet, although not all will work with every system. The computer virus is an outcome of the computer overgrowth in the 1980s. The cause of the term computer virus is the likeness between the biological virus and the evil program infected with computers. The origin of this term came from an American science fiction, The Adolescence of P1, written by Thomas J. Ryan, published in 1977. Human viruses invade a living cell and turn it into a factory for manufacturing viruses. However, computer viruses are small programs. They replicate by attaching a copy of themselves to another program. Once attached to the host program, the viruses then look for other programs to infect. In this way, the virus can spread quickly throughout a hard disk or an entire organization when it affects a LAN or a multi-user system. At some point, determined by how the virus was programmed, the virus attacks. The timing of the attack can be linked to a number of situations, including a certain time or date, the presence of a particular file, the security privilege level of the user, and the number of times a file is used. Likewise, the mode of attack varies. So-called benign viruses might simply display a message. Malignant viruses are designed to damage the system. The attack is to wipe out data, to delete files, or to format the hard disk. There are four main types of viruses: shell, intrusive, operating system, and source code. Shell viruses wrap themselves around a host program and don't modify the original program. Shell programs are easy to write, which is why about half of viruses are of this type. Intrusive viruses invade an existing program and actually insert a portion of themselves into the host program. Intrusive viruses are hard to write and very difficult to remove without damaging the host file. Shell and intrusive viruses most commonly attack executable program files, those with a .com or .exe extension, although data files are also at some risk. Operating system viruses work by replacing parts of the operating system with their own logic. It is very difficult to write operating system viruses, and these viruses have the ability, once booted up, to take total control of your system. For example, some operating system viruses have hidden large amounts of attack logic in falsely marked bad disk sectors. Source code viruses are intrusive programs, and they are also inserted into a source program, such as those written in Pascal prior to the program being compiled. They are the least common viruses because they are not only hard to write, but also have a limited number of hosts compared to the other types. So far, internet has become the main channel through which the computer viruses spread. Look, here come the second network computer viruses. Even without snatching information from the network, your computer can be infected by the second network computer viruses, which are hidden in some machines on the network. Your computer is, so to speak, in danger once being connected to the network to browse. The virus that can steal your money belongs to a kind of the second network viruses. It was designed and put in some machines on the network. When your computer is linked to one of these machines, the virus will invade your hard disk and search whether Intuit Quicken, an accounting software, is installed. One of this accounting software's functions is to transfer accounts automatically. Once infected, your money will be transferred to an additional account opened by the virus program without anybody knowing it. Thank you for your listening, and see you at the next lecture.
第39单元，亚洲崛起。
Unit 39, The Emerging Asia.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor to participate in this important conference. Today I would like to talk about the economic outlook for Asia, focusing mainly on the emerging market economies,and to discuss some of the challenges the region needs to meet to fulfill its enormous potential. Asia showed considerable resilience last year. Supportive macroeconomic policies and the recovery of the global economy helped the region to bounce back from the geopolitical uncertainties in the second half of the year. Propelled by a resurgence of domestic demand and the highest export growth in nearly 3 years,Non-Japan Asia was once again the fastest-growing region in the world. Looking further ahead, while there are reasons to be optimistic, important challenges and risks are present. The baseline scenario for the following year that there will be growth in the global economy and the growth in Asia will slow down marginally as expansion in some key economies reverts closer to potential. However, there are challenges to sustaining world growth. These include making progress with an orderly resolution of global current account imbalances, managing the transition to higher interest rates in industrial countries, and a likely rise in spreads on emerging market debt, and addressing difficult fiscal situations in many industrial countries and some emerging market ones, including here in Asia. Each of these challenges, if not addressed properly, carries a risk of weakening the global recovery on which Asia is dependent. I will now discuss four areas where policymakers need to focus in the period ahead to strengthen prospects for sustained growth. First, exchange rate policy in light of global current account imbalances. Second, the need for further progress with structural reforms. Third, ensuring that public debt levels are reduced. And lastly, regional economic cooperation. The large current account imbalances in the world economy are a concern because of the risk of disorderly adjustment that could disrupt global growth. Asia, with its sizable current account surpluses, is a significant part of this pattern of imbalances, although the current account deficit in the United States is, of course, the most prominent element. And because of its dependence on the strength of the global economy, Asia has much to gain from an orderly resolution of this problem. What is required is a cooperative approach with each region playing its part and with the burden of adjustment fairly shared. A second challenge for many countries in Asia is to press ahead with still incomplete structural reforms, especially those needed to bolster domestic demand. Financial and corporate restructuring has been uneven across the region. Despite the progress made, many banks and corporates remain saddled by weak balance sheets, hampering the recovery of investment needed for more balanced and durable growth. Also, legal and regulatory reforms in many Asian countries have lagged. This has prevented the improvements of the investment climate. The list of unfinished business includes effective bankruptcy laws, tighter prudential oversight, and improved disclosure and governance in the capital markets. A third challenge facing emerging Asia is to make sure that the burden of public debt remains manageable. Emerging market countries as a group have public debt ratios that are now higher than the industrial countries. The growth in public debt in emerging Asia since the mid-1990s has been particularly rapid, with the debt burden rising from some 40% of aggregate GDP in 1996 to about 65% now. This increase reflects, of course, the need to recapitalize banking systems during the financial crisis in the region. As a result, emerging Asia now has a debt-to-GDP ratio significantly larger than Latin American or the group of transition economies. Finally, I want to touch upon the issue of regional economic integration and cooperation in Asia. Regional initiatives are afoot to improve financial cooperation. The Chiang Mai network of bilateral swap agreements, whose amounts are quite large, could play a significant role if a participating country ever got into financial difficulties. And the efforts underway to spur the development of regional bond markets, while still at an early stage, should help diversify sources of finance away from the banking systems and limit reliance on foreign currency debt. I see these initiatives, which the IMF has supported, as reflecting a desire to enhance policy collaboration in the region. Indeed, the policy dialogue that is taking place in a variety of regional fora is fostering institutional reforms and financial stability. Ladies and gentlemen, Asia is the most dynamic region in the world and is set this year to continue to grow rapidly. The outlook for further into the future is also promising, though there are important policy changes that still need to be addressed. Looking back at the tremendous progress that Asia has made over the last decades, I am confident that reforms in the region will continue in the right direction and that Asia is destined to become an even stronger force in the world economy. Thank you.
第四十单元，亚洲合作。
Unit 40, Asian Cooperation.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
I'm very glad to have this opportunity to participate in this forum with its theme, Asia Searching for Win-Win Development Through Cooperation. It is a very timely and important theme. I am glad for two reasons. First,The conditions are now ripe for us to realize the vision of Asia developing through cooperation. I believe it is only through such cooperation that we will ensure the continued prosperity of all our people. Second, I like to think that we embody the spirit of development through cooperation, and I would like to share with you some recent events that you might find useful in your discussions.The vision of the peoples of Asia cooperating with each other for their mutual benefit and prosperity is not new. We may recall the year when the leaders of Asia and Africa, including the great giants of the time, Premier Zhou Enlai, President Sukarno, and Prime Minister Nehru, met in Bandung for the first time to discuss ways to work together to bring progress and prosperity to their peoples.I like to think that the meetings are, in a way, a continuation of this process. The leaders at Bandung had a vision of cooperation, but the political, social, and economic conditions of the time were not quite right. Asia was divided by the Cold War, and the countries of the region were preoccupied with their own problems, the challenges of the post-colonial period, and recovering from the ravages of World War II.Therefore, it has not been possible to develop, to work together, to reach out to each other as much as we have wanted to. But conditions have clearly changed. In the last few decades, particularly in the last two, a great spurt of development has transformed the economies of the region. Our economies have diversified, and we now produce an entire range of goods and services.That makes regional trade very viable. We are generating capital flows that make regional investment an important tool for growth. Peace and stability have brought the countries of the region closer together and have made possible trade and investment, progress and prosperity. We have seen concerted efforts to link our regional economies together as embodied in APEC, in ASEAN,plus China, Japan, and Korea, the so-called 10 plus 3 process that we all hope will lead first to an Asian free trade area, then an Asian Pacific free trade area, and ultimately to a global free trade area. I would like to echo the opinion that Asia will not be prosperous if we exclude the other trading partners. We must work together on a global basis.Take China's robust economies such as Hong Kong, the Pearl River Delta, and the Yangtze River Delta. We have watched and participated in these developments with great interest. We are very much impressed because these economic models are based on being open to trade and investment flows from all over the world, and on providing a world-class business platform that those within the region and beyond may use and benefit from.In these efforts, the local economies have been greatly helped by the central government of the country. For example, an economic partnership agreement known as SIPA was recently concluded under which a range of goods manufactured in Hong Kong will enjoy duty-free access to the mainland. Also enhancing Hong Kong's value as a business platform is the growing integration of the Pearl River Delta,which, as you know, is one of the world's fastest-growing regions. Several major cross-boundary infrastructure projects, roads, railways, bridges will strengthen Hong Kong's links with the Delta. But perhaps more important than the infrastructure is the agreement that Hong Kong has reached with the authorities in Guangdong to work more closely together as a regional economy that embraces Hong Kong, Macau, and the Pearl River Delta. This will be a huge regional economy. Today, Hong Kong and the Pearl River Delta have a population of 60 million people, with a GDP of about $250 billion. In 10 years' time, we believe the combined GDP of the region will be about $500 billion. Hong Kong and Shanghai, two of China's economically most important cities, agreed to build closer links and have identified 8 areas of cooperation, including transport, airports and ports, logistics, investment, trade, and financial services. In each of these areas, we will look for ways to leverage our respective strengths for the benefit of both parties. Let me put it to you that the agreements reached between Hong Kong, the Pearl River Delta, and the Yangtze River Delta are fine models for the sort of cooperation that leads to win-win development. In each of these cases, we have pooled Hong Kong's competitive strengths, the world-class business and financial services, the business-friendly low-tax environment, the excellent infrastructure, and a clean and efficient government, with the competitive strengths of its partners to create a situation in which the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
第四十一单元，美欧关系。
Unit 41, U.S.-EU Relation.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Today I'd like to share with you my view on the U.S.-European relations. Current relations between the United States and Europe should not be misread as being on the brink. They are not, however, as has been seen, immune to tension. The United States was decidedly split with France and Germany over the decision to use military force to remove Iraq's ex-president Saddam Hussein. Consequently, cross-Atlantic ties have been the chilliest since the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s. U.S.-European relations have increasingly been at odds. The divergence has manifested in politics, security, economy, and society. Politically, the United States pursues a global strategy in which it wields world dominance that it is not willing to share. While the EU's global strategy includes building a unified and strong Europe through integration, all in the spirit of a multilateral world. Washington stressed in its national security strategy that it would reinforce its leading role in shaping world structure with its unchallenged might. In response to this, French President expressed his view that a world with only one dominant strength is dangerous, which is why he supports multilateralism. He also noted that Europe would occupy a niche in this multilateral structure. EU High Representative for the Common Foreign and Security Policy also stated in public that the EU has now assumed an important role in the world, so the organization should become a pillar of a more unified, just, stable, and freer world. Politicians and scholars in both United States and Europe have put forth different theories to support their respective political ideas. The United States has churned out several theories and dogmas, such as the so-called axis of evil, preemptive strike, neo-unilateralism, neo-imperialism, Lewisism, and neo-Christian fundamentalism. The essence of such ideologies is to underline that the world has entered an era of U.S. rule. The chaos in international relations demands, these thinkers reckon, that the United States assume a sort of new empire. As part of this theory, if necessary, The United States will fight international terrorism through preemptive military campaigns, toppling axis of evil countries by force so as to impose an American-style democracy and legal system. Old Europeans talk about effective multilateralism, preventive diplomacy, division of political work, and equal strategic partnership. These ideas intend to strengthen multilateral institutions and shape a new international order that is stable and just. They propose international relations be bound by common law, applicable to everyone. As for the so-called rogue nations, European governments suggest preventive diplomacy and oppose taking extreme or unilateral actions to change governments through force. In terms of security, as it tries to speed up the deployment of a national missile defense system, the Bush administration has withdrawn from the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Landmine Ban Treaty, the Biological Weapons Pact, and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. It also still defines the Iraq War as a counter-terrorist effort. Meanwhile, old Europe has opposed Washington's military actions in Iraq from the beginning and been discontented with U.S. withdrawal from all these international treaties and conventions. The divergence between the two sides over military affairs can also be seen in the struggle for controlling European security affairs. Since the collapse of communist governments in the Soviet Union and East Europe, the United States has tried to use NATO as a trump card to put a leash on Europe, actively supporting NATO's eastward expansion. But simultaneously, the EU has begun implementing the European Security and Defense Policy. A corresponding eastward expansion of NATO and the EU is accelerating the building of a solely European rapid response force. U.S.-EU trade disputes and economic conflicts of interest are frequent. The EU is expanding and integrating a common European market, issuing a single currency, the euro. This has strengthened its economic edge to contend with the United States. After the Cold War, the United States, acting as the world's sole superpower, will inevitably tread over some of Europe's interests. More Europeans are now feeling averse to U.S. foreign policy. European leaders are coming up with their own political concepts to distinguish themselves from the Americans, such as European characteristics and European values. Ultimately, the U.S. strategy of pursuing world dominance will run counter to the EU's dream of a big Europe. Thus, the United States could see the EU as its biggest potential rival to hoard power. Right-wing political forces in power in the United States are not willing to see an independent Europe threaten the strategic interests of America. This is the foundation of U.S.-EU conflict.